and welcome to the Monday Mile podcast. This podcast is for you to inspire, to motivate, to give you a little pick-me-up when you need it most. So stick your headphones in and join us for a little walk whilst we walk and talk. Today's guest joins us from the Cotswolds. She's been a pioneer in the pit lane, becoming the first woman to take on the main anchor role in F1 on British TV. She's worked across some of the most prestigious events in sport: Olympics, Paralympics, Wimbledon, and the Rugby World Cup. She's the consummate professional, one of the greats, and delivers when it really counts, under pressure and live in our living rooms. Lee McKenzie, welcome to the Monday Mile podcast.
Thank you so much. You can tell that you are straight off the snow and I'm straight off the snowfall, because I am wrapped up, like I'm in the middle of winter and you're like jacket open, no gloves, no hat.
Yeah, but you know what? I actually really feel the cold and I'm freezing, but I just didn't have enough room in my bag. And I'll tell you something, I hate carrying stuff.
Yeah.
So more often than not, I always come underdressed. And yeah, I've definitely done that today.
But I love this. Like, for me, getting out for a walk in this weather, I like winter. My friends think I love it, yeah. And so cold, crisp days, I find it really invigorating. I love a cold winter walk. Do you know what's strange? I think the last time that I saw you was the hottest day of the year. Last year, everyone would have been advised not to be outside. We were outside, 40 degrees.
It was brilliant.
It was painfully hot, but this like gives me a lot of energy.
I was in my element. That's actually my environment. I love
you. You chose the wrong career when you started off.
I clearly did. That's now why I'm attempting to do a lot of chatting for a living. So you know this area of London relatively well.
Yeah.
You spent a bit of time here during lockdown. What's special to you about this area?
Well, it was strange because lockdown was an interesting time for everyone. The first lockdown was almost guilt-free living, which I don't think that anyone has ever done. When you got over the fear, you realised that you weren't missing out on work, you weren't missing out on days out, you weren't actually missing out on anything, because nothing happened. So that was a bit of a revelation. And then when things started to get back up to speed, I needed to be in London so I could do work, because sport was continuing. But I found myself with an awful lot of time myself, which you were meant to be anyway, really. And I walked, and I walked, and I walked. And I went round Hyde Park. And what was nice for me, coming from, you know, an equestrian background, is that I could see the household cavalry exercising the horses. I gave myself weird little challenges, like,
oh, go on,
when you were going out for a walk, just so you weren't sort of in your own mind, to look for things. So I gave myself like four things to look for, which probably would work better if I was maybe in like the Serengeti or somewhere dramatic, because I had to spot a predator.
A predator, okay.
So that dog, we'll go for that dog.
Okay, yeah, it's a husky, it's a dog, right?
That a counts. Bird. Okay. And at this time of year, some winter berries and new life. Now, new life could be like some buds or whatever, but it was just to try and keep myself present on this walk. I think I must have read it somewhere. I wouldn't have come up with something quite as highbrow as that. But it was just to sort of keep myself, when I was on a walk, out my head, to look around, to just enjoy what I was seeing. Because I love nature. I love being outside. Sometimes you can just walk and you actually forget to look around you. So that,
so
to me,
true.
Is what that sort of lockdown time was. Just marching around Hyde Park, walking around these streets. And also what you realise, not coming from London, obviously, you can tell by the accent, is you think that London is this massive, huge city, which it is, but everything's a lot closer than you think. So people go like one stop on the tube.
Yeah.
And they could have walked it in 3 minutes.
So true. When there's no traffic, London's a small place. Is there any element of those four pillars that you mentioned that you've carried into the non-lockdown lifestyle?
I still love walking. I still love the balance of being outside and not filling my time with work. It used to panic me, not working when you're freelance. But at the same time, maybe you get to a point where you're slightly more comfortable of that. You know, you're maybe not looking over your shoulder as much as you used to. But I think that's a natural thing when you work in the environment that I do. I think I'm probably a little bit more relaxed. I'm sure some of my family and friends would say that's definitely not the case, but I try to be, and I think I have the awareness now to try to be, and that's half the battle.
too right. It certainly is. Your career started relatively young.
Yeah.
Age 15.
Yeah. I used to get a Monday morning off school to go into the local newspaper. I would have gone to rugby on a Saturday, and I would have watched the match, reported on the match, interviewed the players. Now when I think back, I'm like, who in the right mind would let their child do this? But I grew up in this sort of Fleet Street environment. My father was a Fleet Street journalist, and I would get this Monday morning off school, and off I'd go, and I'd write it up for the newspaper. I had an equestrian column as well, horsing around with Lee McKenzie.
Brilliant.
And yeah, and I just liked that idea of writing, and I've still got all those cuttings. I don't hoard things really, but I think sometimes when I look back on that, I'm like, I don't know sometimes if it feels like the same person. It's weird. It's a really strange thing.
So you started in news, hardcore news, Lockerbie disaster.
Yeah.
How did one go from that environment into sport? Because now you're predominantly there.
Yeah, it was strange. But because I had started when I was 15 in sport, and the day I was offered the news job in television, I was also offered a job at a national newspaper as the chief rugby correspondent or something. I was 20, and I had in my mind that actually all these older guys who, you know, my father and everyone, who I knew them all, but that's what my father did, would they really listen to me? And it was a guaranteed salary for a year and all this stuff, and because the newspaper was just starting, and I took a bit of a risk. I thought, or maybe I was just arrogant, I thought, no, do you know what? I can do newspapers. I'm going to try something different. I'll do television. And I was always told to be a good, and I subscribe to this, and I think this is a hugely important point for anyone who's listening. To be a good sports journalist, you need to be a good journalist.
Okay.
And I think that you've got to be able to separate the sort of fan in you.
Yeah.
To have enthusiasm, of course. But, you know, just be a bit measured in these situations. And obviously you can't like be going to news and going, oh God, that was a great disaster. That was a great situation. You don't think like that.
No.
You can distance yourself from things. And I was always told to be able to be a good, whatever it be, arts journalist, sports journalist, you know, fashion journalist. You just have to know the basics well enough that you can be a good journalist. I think I thought that I really wanted to be deep into news, war reporter, all that sort of thing. But in hindsight, I would have been terrible because I'm too soft for all that thing. And you have to be quite hard into it, or maybe you become hard into it. But doing the Lockerbie trial wasn't easy. You know, I remember it as a child. Lockerbie's not too far from where I grew up. Apparently the plane was, well, not apparently, but the plane is on the flight path would have gone from Lockerbie straight over our town. So,
wow.
You know, it's fine margins, but it was interesting then doing the court case and the trial at Camp Zeist, because you know, it's still in the newspapers to this very day. I still read with interest on it because it's something which has been part of my life from when it happened when I was a child to actually reporting on how the whole thing unfolded.
What do you believe the makeup is of a good journalist? You mentioned the word good.
Well, I think journalism sometimes has it's like a dirty word.
Yeah.
It depends how you do it. Not every journalist is out there to nail someone to the masts to get a story out of every single thing they do. And I think that the way I interview, and you know, a lot of people talk about it, I get quite big storylines that maybe allure people into this false sense of security. Mark Webber actually said when he was writing a thing for the back of my book, it was like, Lee somehow gets us to say things that we should never say out loud. And I think that's quite a good thing, because maybe I do lure people into a false sense of security. And also, there is a bit of a method, you know, in that sort of F1 pen.
Yeah.
Or in rugby, when I do Six Nations and things, you tend to get like three questions. I always think you need to, even if it's a friend of yours, ask the ones that matter, ask what people want to hear at home. But you can't go so hard with a question that no, you're not going to get an answer.
Yeah.
Because really, in that case, you're not facilitating, you're not doing it for what you're, you know, what people want to hear at home. You're just doing it for your own ego. Wow, look at me, I can ask a really massive, big, ballsy question. Anyone can. That's not the art of being a journalist.
It's
extracting the information. So yeah, start with a reasonably nice question, then go hard for the second question, finish with a smiley question. Make everyone feel that it was okay in the end.
You're like, it's okay.
I'm a nice person.
You just said something you shouldn't have, but exactly. Hey, we've got it on camera.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's hardcore though, actually. I've never thought about
it like that. But you do think about it. And if I, you shouldn't just be blundering into any interview, that even when it sounds conversational and even when... it sounds a little bit haphazard sometimes when people go joking off and all the rest of it. You still should have an idea of what you want to get out of a situation, and that comes from prep.
Yeah.
And as you know, you could do 1,000 hours of prep and probably you'll use about 45 minutes of the information. Then you go home thinking, oh, I could have said this and I should have said this. But when you've done that prep, that's actually what gives you the confidence to go into these interviews and things.
Prep is power in that when it goes wrong, that's
absolutely.
You really need the preparation,
absolutely.
Right?
And you know, it's not you're not really paid for when things go right, you're paid for when things go wrong, because then it is sink or swim. And I actually quite like that madness when everything's falling to pieces and you're sort of like standing there and you can hold your own. It is quite an empowering feeling. I mean, don't get me wrong, you do not want this all the time, but yeah, I think it's an art. Done properly, I think it can be a real art.
I think that's also where the addiction and the excitement in live broadcast comes alive, because for me, that's where the two, sport and broadcast, run parallel together.
Yeah.
Because for me, it's definitely the closest high I've had to throwing myself upside down. And you're like, oh, what are they going to say?
Exactly.
You know, it's very reactive.
I think that's the whole important thing. Listen to the answer. Because if you have your three questions written down in advance, and it's good to have a guide.
Yeah.
But if someone says that, you know, you've not paid attention, they go, actually, do you know what? It was such a bad day. I'm going to retire. And tell me about what happened in lap 22.
I mean, mate, you've just given me gold.
Exactly. Just listen to the answer. So, yeah.
So true.
It's actually quite basic. when you break it down.
Yeah, it's just having a conversation. When it comes to sport and broadcast, I believe there's certain elements that I've taken from my sporting career into this new profession. So as someone that's sat on the other side, you've spent years in Formula One, one of the most elite professions there is. Have you had any learnings from being in that pit lane?
Well, I suppose you can break it down into a couple of things. Maybe I see things differently because I wasn't good enough to actually do any of the sports that I talk about, which people might say, well, you're not qualified to be there, but kind of that is broadcasting in many ways.
Yeah.
So, you know, I see things through different eyes. I don't pretend that I was good enough to have been there.
Yeah.
You know, I think sometimes people do.
You kind of hear that quite a lot.
Yeah.
I was a former... Yes, or a form of that. I almost.
Yeah, and I'm about to say something very similar.
Ooh.
I competed in several rounds in rallying.
Okay.
And I was there because I was on TV. That is the only reason I was there. But it went quite well. I did a couple of rounds of the World Rally Championship. But what was interesting is I was being followed by a camera crew. And I hated them.
Really?
Oh my God, it drove me mad. Like, get this camera out of my face. What are you asking these stupid questions for? It drove me insane. And it actually really let me see how irritating it is
when
somebody like me turns up. Because, you know, I've said this to Nick Kyrgios at Wimbledon, I've said it to other people as well, but, you know, nobody picks up a tennis racket or gets in a cart or kicks a rugby ball with the hope of being interviewed by someone like me. That is just part and parcel of the job now.
Yeah.
But it's not the sole reason that somebody wants to get involved in sport, without a shadow of a doubt. Some people absolutely embrace and love the media side, others don't. But I think that when you have sort of seen it from both sides, as you certainly have, you probably can have a bit more empathy with it, because you know when to go in and when to back off.
There's definitely an expectation to adopt that lifestyle side as an athlete now. It is expected, isn't it, to perform, almost play up to the media. So having been on the other side, or having dabbled in it, I didn't know you were a driver. Love that.
Co-driver.
Co-driver.
Just left and right. Slow down. I said a lot of slow down.
So that's helped you with a better understanding of when to go in or not? Or has it given you more of a, you know what, I know where I can push the boundaries?
Well, no, I think it's just probably when to back off a little bit. But at the same time, no. it's common sense, I think, a lot of it as well. I mean, how you act if you're on a national newspaper is going to be different to how you act in television. Also, let's not forget, you know, 23 races on a Formula One calendar. If you piss everybody off in race one, it's not going to be a fun 22 races still to go.
No.
So, you know, there's a little bit of managing a situation. Again, it doesn't mean to say that you don't ask questions as and when they're needed.
Yeah.
I just always believe there's a way in which to ask something.
Interesting.
And also, go and square it off with someone afterwards. If you have had like a proper blowout conversation, yeah, then you go to them and explain what you're doing. And I think most athletes now across all sports understand that everyone is playing a game to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that disrespectfully, but they know why we are here and we know what they have to do, whether they like it or not.
Both rugby and F1 are fairly male-dominated sports. Hmm. When it comes to stepping into that environment, or the first time you stepped into that environment, did you ever feel inferior or unwelcome?
No, I must say that I never have. I mean, maybe it's because in both of those sports, I was known as Bob's daughter before actually I was known for having a job. But ultimately, when I got the job, I had to be good enough to hold on to it.
Yeah.
It's not something that I have ever found, or maybe I think sometimes maybe I do just sort of blinker off to it. I know that other people would disagree and they would say that they have been made to feel inferior, but I never wake up in a morning and think, do you know what, I'm going to be the best girl to ask a question today.
Yeah.
Because then you're only seeing 50% of the bigger picture.
You want to
be
the best
person to ask a question today. The chances are that might not happen, but I've never limited myself, and maybe that's because of, you know, being put into these situations as a kid. Maybe it's just because I was brought up that way, but I have never found my gender limiting.
Did you ever feel a pressure or expectation being the daughter of?
It's different, I think, maybe how I conduct myself and things, but now I'm quite a private person anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm not sort of like going wild running around and sort of bringing everyone into disrepute. That's not how I act generally.
Yeah.
So I just think I put pressure on me. Without a doubt, I put pressure on me to be good and to try and be good. I think it's more on me than anyone else.
So when it comes to a season on the road, Formula One is extremely extensive in terms of the travel.
Yeah.
I thought the World Snowboard Tour was bad, 6 weeks, six countries, but Formula One, you've got a pretty much a full year of it,
yeah,
nigh on 2 or 3 months. And then you've got the rugby, and then you've got Wimbledon.
Mm.
How do you juggle and manage your time within that? Because life on the road is not easy.
No, it's not. And again, you learn that as you go through it. What happens in year one and two is you either go out lots and you have fun and you explore all these great places and you burn the candle at both ends, basically. And that happens to everyone. That happened to me. It happens to everyone. And through life and getting older and just understanding this, I actually went, because I realized I was a bit out of my depth with all of this, and I went over to a friend who sadly isn't with us now, but the company still is very much with us, and it's called Hintze Perform, and they're huge and they're based in Switzerland. And I decided that the best way I could do is, on my meagre budget in comparison to Formula One drivers,
yeah,
is how can I conduct myself? How can they get off a plane and perform at the highest level? So I wanted to put myself into that situation.
Wow.
I know it sounds very arrogant, but I've always just being surrounded by athletes and things, it's like, treat yourself as a brand. What is best for you? So I went there, and it was stupid things like, don't have your phone beside your bed. Stop checking your phone before you go to sleep. When you're on a plane, instantly flip on to that time. So eat when you're meant to eat. Don't just keep grazing throughout an entire flight. Sleep when you need to sleep, as if you were in Australia or Malaysia, even if you're in the UK or on a plane. So I started to do those sort of little, what we call life hacks now.
Yeah.
and it did make a difference. But again, sometimes you pay great attention to it and other times you don't. But I'm much, much better at it now. What is tricky is prepping for one event when you're at a different event. So normally what happens is when I do a Wimbledon, there'll be an Olympics coming up, and then after an Olympics, there's a Paralympics coming up. And sometimes I think I'm constantly prepping for the wrong event when I'm, you know,
when you're there.
When I'm there, and that's a really difficult thing to get my head around. But it happens once every 4 years. So,
and how do you manage that when you're in that situation? Because I can imagine you've got to be extremely disciplined to get through the broadcast you're on. Because let's be open and honest, like, a 2 week broadcast is no easy feat in any sport. It requires discipline. You've got to be switched on.
Yeah.
There's so many different factors, as well as managing the environment and all of the people around you and the people you're working with, to then come into yourself and start, say you're at Wimbledon, prepping for a Summer Olympics.
Yeah.
How do you open your mind to
2016
that?
Was tough. 2017, I had this real watershed moment where I was just, enough, I can't do it. 2016, I did, Channel 4 had just got the F1 right, so everything was different, but I was still doing BBC, as I am now. And I was at Wimbledon, and I was in my little hotel room at the time, that year, and I was prepping for the Olympics. But whilst I was in Rio for the Olympics, I was prepping for the Paralympics. And that was difficult. You know, I didn't do it like that for Tokyo. So again, you learn what's right or wrong in those situations, because also there's only so much you can take in. Because go back to your school days when you were meant to be prepping for exams. If you were like, okay, well, that's biology, now on to history, and now on to this, you're not really taking anything in.
No.
You know, it just becomes a wall of words, and you're just reading stuff, and you're like, don't understand any of it. But I also think, and it sounds like it's an absolute cheat, but before Wimbledon, I just watched every single ball hit in the French Open.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can use live events, and I completely appreciate it. Watching sport is not a proper job. So if my prep or my work is watching sport to be ready for the event that I go to, I always feel it's a bit of a cheat. But in those days when my friends or whatever are saying, do you want to come out? And I'm like, no, I'm working. So that to me is work.
Yeah, I think from the outside it can sound glamorous and it can sound glossy, but still there's an extreme amount of discipline to take on that information. You can't go out and get smashed and then get up and remember everything you've just watched. You have to take care of yourself.
And some people do. I just have never done that really. You know, there will be places you go to and, like, you don't get me wrong, there's party or something like that, or you would go to certain countries in F1 and then, but you would do it on the Wednesday night. You don't do it on the Saturday night.
No.
And also, F1 is so different now, you couldn't do it like that. But even, you know, prepping for Six Nations and things, you know, my weekend was basically watching rugby. So I caught up with friends in the morning, but then came back home to watch rugby. Now, I appreciate, again, that's not a proper job, but, you know, my friends are like, you're doing what? I'm like, what? So they're like, so you're working? And I'm like, well, I'm not working, as in I'm not being paid to work. However, you know, I do, this is my prep, so this
I'm
is
banking.
My work.
I'm banking the knowledge.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
Is there a particular warmth towards one sport? You work across a lot of different sports.
I do. I mean, I love Formula One is what I sort of grew up in. It's certainly not easy, but I walk in there and I know lots of people, so it's, you instantly feel that sort of familiarity, which is lovely. So you've almost, it's like a head start, because you can walk up and down the paddock a lot. Again, what you do sometimes is you walk up and down, you chat to people, how are you, what's happening, blah blah blah, people open up to you and you get this bank of knowledge. That doesn't really happen in other sports, a little bit in rugby actually. Wimbledon I love doing, but they are the longest days that I do all year. It's just 2 weeks, and also because I have to do the British Grand Prix in the middle of it.
Oh, that's so, chaos.
Total chaos. I mean, last year I did Goodwood Festival of Speed for ITV Saturday, Sunday, drove up to London, did Wimbledon Monday to Thursday for BBC, presented for Channel 4 the practice sessions at Silverstone Friday, W Series on Sky on the Saturday, back to Channel 4 for the British Grand Prix on a Sunday and then left to do the final week of Wimbledon for BBC. So also that's three broadcasters. So you're looking at your mic, you're like, what is happening? Four broadcasters.
Where am I?
Four broadcasters. I can't even add up. So yeah, that kind of thing is madness.
So after an intense 2 weeks, four different channels, four different broadcasts, how do you switch off?
I can't even think what I did actually. I should have locked myself in my house, but I don't think I did.
We bumped into you.
We did, yeah, that's right. I think I probably just went. It was intent on going to the gym.
And you definitely did that.
I did.
Everybody else around us that day was drinking. I wasn't actually.
No, go on,
the athlete. And you managed to get into the gym on the hottest day of the year.
I went in because of the air conditioning. What I do. Like is to, you know, I would get outside. I'd either go up to Scotland and see family. You know, we live at a beach, so it's such an easy place to go and just lose yourself. Like go up to the horses. My background's horses, so that is really important to me, just to do normal things, to switch off. I'm not very good at going to like sports events or concerts or things like that, which yeah. I should do because it'd be great fun. But I'm just a bit like, well, I don't know, loads of people and queuing to get in somewhere. That's kind of what I do. Anyway,
yeah, like, you're know, around it in that
you're around the environment.
The
so so I kind of do the opposite and just extract myself from things, spend time with friends, family, just switch off.
And the horse riding,
yeah,
I don't know much about equestrian. You also work in that and you enjoy it for leisure. When it comes to having a passion and a solid body of work, how do you merge the two and find the enjoyment?
Well, that's a really good point, because actually when I left News, I went and joined at the races and I thought I was going to love it. I thought this was going to be the best job that I've ever had because it is my passion. And I didn't like a minute of it because it changed the whole outlook for me on it. It changed the bias. I didn't get the same enjoyment out of working in it full time. So I'm fortunate I dip in and out in terms of the events I cover. I'll probably only do maybe three a year.
It's interesting I personally find I like to try and keep the two separate, but it's not easy when the two collide. Sometimes you question yourself, do I need to separate them?
Yeah.
If I can get paid to do what I love, surely that's the best answer. But actually holding a little bit back for yourself is...
I think that's really important, and it doesn't matter if it's what you do away from your job, as it were, what you do in your private life, you know, your partner, all that sort of thing. I always have kept that part very separate, because otherwise, what's left?
Yeah.
You know, when you go home and close the door, kind of what's left? Everything, so many people, and that's their call, and it's not a judgment, but put everything out there. I'm just not that kind of person. I'm not comfortable with that anyway. So I think it's so important for me to just keep something back.
It's so, so important. So on a normal day where you're not working,
yeah,
what are we likely to find you doing?
Starting drinking coffee. That's my go-to.
Yes.
That's all I do.
Yes. I'm not going to tell you how many coffees I've had today. I did get up at 5:30, so the number is
impressive.
High.
Well, the one thing actually I travel with in my suitcase, and everyone laughs at me, is like, what? Like, because I don't really take that much luggage. And even we got to Azerbaijan last year, and I had hand luggage, and Sebastian Vettel was like, are you presenting this weekend? I was like, yeah, I am. And he goes, are all your clothes in this one bag? And I said, yes, they are. And he goes, I'll be interested to see what you're going to wear. Like, you didn't believe that I had anything of any worth, like just shorts and t-shirts or something.
The legs are out all week.
I did have a lovely selection of dresses, but in amongst my luggage will always be the AeroPress, because I need to have coffee. I always need to have good coffee wherever I am in the world.
How about the milk? Are you fussy about the milk?
I'll take it black.
Black, right.
I can't get into the sort of disappointment of the milk situation. I don't ever have fluffy milk. Black.
That's where I am.
Tiny dog.
It's bad. I think I need to get back into the black coffee. Yeah. On the last trip I was on, it got to the point where I was actually carrying around the milk with me.
That's too much. It's too far, isn't it?
But hey, I don't travel with an AeroPress, but maybe I'll get one today. Ready for tomorrow.
Ready for tomorrow. Actually, you're going to get good coffee where you're going.
I am.
Basically, I start my day, drink coffee. Depends what I'm doing. I mean, I will always try and see friends or go for a long walk. I'm more than happy to go for a long walk myself. But just get outside. And then that is kind of difficult to remember because the last 2 years was taken up with writing a book. So even when I wasn't on camera, you'd get up and sit at a laptop and type and all the rest of it. And now that's stopped. I was a little bit like, oh goodness, what do I do with myself? So because I expect to be in France quite a bit this year for work and next year Olympics, Paralympics, I've enrolled in French classes.
To try
and get myself up to speed again, because I did it at school, not to any great level. I was better at German, but so that's what I'm doing. I want to, by the time I go to France later in the year, I want to be, you know, properly speaking it.
So in your downtime,
you're learning. I'm learning, yeah. I don't like to be still. And that doesn't mean being not...
So constantly moving forward and progressing.
Yeah, I don't mean necessarily active.
I could do with a bit of that because I'm always one to be active.
You're active, yeah.
Whereas,
no, I see you're
probably be good to sit still.
I don't know how you fit it all in. When I see your social, I'm like, oh my gosh, you inspire to get out and do stuff. I would be a little bit more of a bookworm.
Did you enjoy the process of writing your book?
Yeah, I did. What's strange is when you have to hand it over to someone else. That's the bit that sort of makes me go, oh my gosh, you know.
You can see my eyeballs, I'm like, oh.
Yeah, I find that a bit stressful.
Why did you find that a bit hard? Because someone's going to essentially tear through it and potentially ask you to change things?
Yeah, or? And also because it was done on my experiences, my stories, but essentially the careers of seven drivers. So the only thing to change should be my bad grammar and punctuation. So I didn't necessarily distance myself as much as I should, but I think everyone who's... That was the first book I've written, possibly the last, but I think everyone who goes through that for the first time feels that. I've spoken to a lot of people and they're like, it's horrible. You know, even when you get it back, the way that it's all set out and highlighted, it's almost like an assignment. It's like...
It kind of is, like, you're
kind of reading it in the wrong way and it's all broken up. There's no meaning to it, so... But yeah, I mean, it seems to have been well received, so I'll just take
that. You've obviously rejigged it and made it the way you like it.
Yeah.
Because it's been a success.
Yeah.
For those people that haven't had the opportunity to read it yet, can you give us any little nuggets or takeaways that would maybe inspire our listeners to pick up Inside F1?
Well, it's a strange one because it's, you know, I've been asked to write books about me, and again, I think that would be hugely boring. So.
But you know what that is? Sorry, I'm going to pause you. It's hugely telling of who you are.
Yeah, it probably is.
You're not self-absorbed by your achievements.
No, and I'm also doing these jobs because I can't do what they're doing, and that's always very sort of at the forefront of my mind. So I took seven drivers who my career has been sort of interlinked with, and I tell the story of their careers, but using my personal stories and interactions with them. So you do start when, you know, they go karting and you finish, you know, where they are now. But there's some funny stories. You know, when I went to Brazil for when Lewis won his first title back in 08, ended up getting sort of held at gunpoint and took a horse from the UK to Michael Schumacher's yard to compete against Michael in the European reigning championships. I only had a 1 hour lesson, I had no idea what I was doing. And that was great fun. You know, shared a hire car a couple of times with Lewis before he got to F1. So, you know, when I say that these stories are being woven through their careers, it very much has, but they are the stars.
Yeah.
You know, they are very much the stars. Because Formula One has never been more popular because of programs on television and things. But if you only watch these sports docs, you only see what's happening at that given moment. It doesn't give you any backstory. It doesn't, you know, let you like a person who's been through a massive big journey, to use that word. But you know, Fernando Alonso wins a race this year. It's really important because it's been so long since he won one. If he won a championship this year, God forbid, he's not won one since, you know, 2005, 2006. So you've got to know what you're watching to appreciate what you're seeing now. You've got to know people's stories, and that's what sort of compelled me to write the book in the first place.
So for our new F1 fans that have watched Drive to Survive,
yeah,
actually, let's get into the backstory.
Yeah, it gives
Pick
context.
Up Lee's book and it will give you a little inspo to understand the pathway. I think that's the incredible thing about F1, as someone who's sat on the outside of it and I've watched you broadcast. In fact, you probably don't even know this. I was in Monaco in 2014. Wow. At the Red Bull Energy Station, and I remember seeing you, Natalie Pinkham, floating around, and I remember thinking, that is so cool what they're doing.
I'm pretending to work.
I want to do that one day. But it's a very intimate circuit and very, very professional. As someone that's worked in it for how many years?
09 was my first full season.
There's two questions here. Yeah. What's your biggest takeaway from the athletes? And what has been the biggest privilege in sharing their journeys?
Well, the biggest takeaway is that Formula One is so different to any other sport. It's kind of obvious, but success, failure is measured by thousandths of a second. So detail is hugely important to these drivers. When you work alongside people like a Mark Webber, a David Coulthard, you know, finished second in the championship DC, won 13 Grand Prix, their life is still measured by detail to the nth degree. When I went to do the rugby, I was working along with Brian Habana, Jamie Heaslip, two of the greatest rugby players of their generation, some would say ever. And after the second match, I sent, there'd been quite a lot of problems, it had been a stressful time, and I was going from Ireland to do the rugby, back to London, London to Texas, Texas to Mexico, but before I did the Mexican Grand Prix I wanted to swim with whale sharks for a couple of days, so I was off to do this thing. Now, so it was a madness of flights, so that blew their minds to begin with, but in amongst all this I wrote a sort of debrief email about, great show guys, this is to all the production, here's what we need to do better, this is what nearly went wrong, this is what went wrong, this is what was really good, blah blah blah, hit send. By the time I got off, I don't know which flight it was, my phone had just lit up and it was like Brian and Jamie going like, oh my god, what is this? We have been professional rugby players, you know, played one World Cups, played for the British and Irish Lions, all that sort of thing. They had never seen anything like that since like their professional playing days, because, and they were like, who is this maniac that we're working with? And that is because that's how we do things in F1. It rubs off on you. I'm not saying it's always good, but you become like almost this machine of detail finely tuned, which when you try and take that into other sports and things, people are like, she's a psychopath, keep away, she's like into so much detail. But I don't think it's a bad thing. It's just something to remember when you're working with new people, I would say. And I think it's always a privilege. I think when, you know, not every day is a fantastic day, but sometimes you're standing in the paddock, you hear a car, you know, get started up, or you look around and you see, and this can be in any sport in actual fact, when you see people who have paid to be somewhere that you're being paid to be at,
yeah,
and you have a love for what you do, I think that's always a great reminder. You know, I used to go to these things as a kid and I would be so excited about getting the chance to go to a Grand Prix or a rugby match or horses or whatever. And of course, when you do it 23 times a year or whatever, you get a little bit jaded sometimes. There's some countries you don't particularly want to go to versus others. But you just have to look around and remind yourself how many other people would like to do that job. And if it's still not enough, then you know that's the time to step back.
That's mad, isn't it? I love the intensity in the F1. I can imagine that's put you in a really strong position, even in terms of awareness when it comes to stepping into another sport. People must see you as such an asset to have that power of knowledge and professionalism.
I think maybe intense would be the word that people would use to describe me.
and probably not always in a good way, but I think, again, it's that understanding of that. I think when there's an understanding that you have that, you know yourself when you've done something or said something, you're a bit like, oh gosh.
You wouldn't come across as somebody who describes himself in a work environment as intense. I think you've got a very soft and open nature. Are the two very segregated when it comes to work and play? Because I've only met you in a non-work environment.
I think they probably are. But I think, again, it does take time and stuff. A lot of people are the same. When I see people in the paddock, there'll be a few people, like, you know, there'll be the Italian me or the, you know, the Finnish me or German. Yeah. And you look around and you see that. It's like, sometimes you can go through an entire weekend and then you get to the next race and someone's like, were you in Austria at the weekend? Yeah, I was. Oh, I didn't see you. And you might have walked past them 10 times, but
it's so internalized.
Full on. In that moment, you're only doing what's in front of you. But yeah, there's some...
Powerful.
It is.
Powerfully.
It is strange. It's a weird way of working, if we can call it work.
What's your relationship like with Monday, the start of the week?
I love the start of a week.
Go on.
I'm kind of someone that likes the... I actually always like a Sunday. I love a Sunday at home because I don't get that many of them.
I was going to say, are you not normally standing in a pit lane on
but
a Sunday?
But I do. I'll go get the papers. I still buy newspapers, all the rest of it. Have chill time, see family or friends, depending on where I am in the world. And I love a Monday. I kind of get excited about a Sunday night going into a Monday. It just feels different. It's the same, the start of a year.
Yeah.
I love the start of a year. It's like a blank page. Yeah.
Blank page. Have you got any aspirations for this year?
I don't really sort of do resolutions because I suppose after years and years of like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, then you get to the point where you're like, that doesn't particularly work for me. I like to have a goal.
Yeah.
You know, everyone wants to be like fitter or stronger or better balance in their life and things like that. But I think if you try and do it over 52 weeks,
It's
too much, so it's breaking it down. You don't suddenly just go, do you know what, I'm going to run a marathon. You probably do, and off you go.
But I've actually got a really rogue story on that.
At the same time, for me, I need to break it down to bite size.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with you. I don't think you can ever go, I'm going to do this. You need to give yourself 3 to 4 steps along the journey with the end goal being a vision point, but not necessarily, or for me anyway, everyone's different, not necessarily something that I'm attached to.
Yes.
So then the journey to that can be fluid.
Yeah, I completely agree, because also, you know, then one setback or one disappointment, it feels like a full blow. You know, it's like, oh God, I don't know if I can come back from this. And it could be doing something, when you're not an athlete, it can be something basic, like, oh, I didn't go to the gym 4 times this week, I only went once. Or, you know, life gets in the way sometimes. And I think you just have to give yourself space to appreciate that. But if the intention is there, then, you know.
It's all good things. We're moving forward. You seem to speak about the gym. How many times would you aim to get in the gym yourself?
Until last week, it had been none for the year.
Yeah.
But then I did go 3 times last week. I went last night, swam outside, went horse riding last week as well. So that was good. So, but again, like when I was in the sort of, the book came out in October last year. So that was such an intense time. I literally don't think I did much for 4 months. I wasn't in the place to be able to do it because every waking moment was making sure something was right. And then when I stopped, I was like, okay, now. And it feels like now is a good time to get back into it. But I do it for, I know I'm not unnaturally, my brother is so annoying. He's like such a naturally fit person. You know, you can just be like, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to just do this. And off he goes and does it. Not like a marathon or anything, but it just works for him, whereas I've never been like that. But I know if I don't do something, I get inside my head. So I do it as much for sort of my mental fitness as I do for my own personal fitness.
It's so much of it is for mental gain for me. For me, it's always the feeling afterwards, the sense
absolutely.
Of achievement. And again, it falls back to those like small, intimate goals. Just by doing a little something, it's always better than doing nothing.
Yeah.
But when you were doing your book and you were in the thick of it and the gym and that part of your routine wasn't accessible, how do you manage that and not punish yourself? Because I think that's another interesting dynamic is when you flip it on its head, and when you are struggling to fit it in, how do you not punish yourself?
Well, I think I do punish myself. I think that's the thing. I mean, I like this sitting in the middle of my living room for about 2 years is this set of Dynabands and weights and a yoga mat. And the yoga mat sometimes only comes out in a month to lift my laptop up for like a Zoom meeting.
when you're in your pajamas at the bottom
half. I do take everything, exactly, I only dress from the waist up. But I do take everything to hotels and try and do something, because I get in my head quite a lot about fitness or weight and things like that. It's not something that's always been easy for me. So I do try and, again, it's like, I wouldn't even have said those words out loud 10 years ago. I wouldn't even have admitted to being stressed about weight and things like that. But I think maybe, again, when you get a little bit older,
yeah,
you just feel more comfortable.
When you feel good, right?
Yeah, when you feel good. Absolutely. It's as simple as that.
Would you say having a career in the spotlight where you're on television, you see yourself back, you watch yourself back, does that make you more aware of your weight and your image?
I think there's times where I absolutely know that I look better than others.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can fall back on, it sounds again arrogant, but I can fall back on, I'm good at my job. But at the same time,
love that.
There is, yeah, of course it affects you. You know, I mean, I get trolled all the time on social media about my weight.
That's disgusting.
But I always have done. I've never been skinny.
You've got a good figure, Lee.
But just a little Michelin man to do. But the point is though that, you know, I wouldn't have said those words out loud 20 years ago because it would have sounded like that's something of a weakness, and maybe I do and blah, blah, blah. But it's just, I think as well there's a lot more. I don't think I would have done my job. I wouldn't have started my job if social media was there when I was starting off. Because yeah. It would have like blown my mind.
Savage out there on the internet, isn't it?
I see how, like, and I'm responsible. Like, you know, I'll sometimes use a filter and things like that. That's not, but it's just a different way for particularly young girls, young boys as well. Let's not forget them. But it's brutal. And there's no way I would be on TV if that had been there when I was starting out.
That's interesting, hey? Yeah.
I didn't even want hair straighteners, but I blame my mum for that.
I've definitely got hair straighteners, but I definitely use them as much as I should.
But I mean, it sounds like vain conversation, but all these things do.
It's not
like,
though,
matter.
It's,
like,
it's very relatable.
It is, yeah.
Do you have any life mottos or quotes that you live by that you can share with our listeners? You can go any way with this.
Well, there's one that I sort of like say. I have these like mottos, which again makes me sound like a sort of like drill sergeant, but one of them is be so good they can't ignore you. It doesn't always work.
I think I want to get that tattooed on my forehead. That's an absolute banger.
And the other one is don't accept criticism from someone that you wouldn't take advice from. So don't listen to criticism from a person if you wouldn't be interested in what advice they had to give you. And I think that is quite a good one.
That's an absolute belter. I like both of those. I'm actually going to write them in my diary. It's not very often I can come away from this podcast and say, I'm actually going to write the quote in my handwritten diary. Yes, I'm one of those people.
I am one of those people. I have a handwritten diary.
Yeah, I've got the two. The visual on the Mac,
yeah.
And then you've got to put it in.
Yep.
So it's there.
Well.
It's official.
It
you're committed.
Official.
Yeah. Lee McKenzie, thank you so much for traipsing all the way into London
Love
to
it.
Meet us on
and
this
sunny day.
Glorious, freezing, but sunny day. I've absolutely loved chatting to you.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. I love it.
I think we've definitely walked a lot more than a mile.
We've walked
well.
A lot more than
you
a mile.
You know what? Would you like to know how far
yes,
we've walked?
Please.
We've almost done 2 miles.
Oh, that's good.
That is. Monday Mile listeners, I really hope you enjoyed that one. Some really strong takeaways. I've thoroughly enjoyed this walk. Lee, I hope you have.
I have. Thank you so much, Debbie.
And to those of you that are tuning into the audio, you know what to do. Please do subscribe. And just remember, this podcast drops every single Monday morning at 1 a.m. So for the early risers, it will be there, ready and waiting for you. Have an absolutely wicked week. It's a wrap.